This is Culturetopia, your weekly roundup of the very best arts and culture stories from NPR. I am Neda Ulaby of NPR's Arts Desk.
And I'm Alicia Montgomery, a producer for Tell Me More.
Just a reminder, you can subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. This week,
actress Annette Bening returns with a movie about the joys and sorrows of motherhood.
Lisa Kudrow on the pleasures of the small screen and her ongoing internet series, Web Therapy.
And Wyclef Jean tells us about a few artists he's currently listening to. But first,
a play adapted from a children's book took the theater world by storm when it opened in London a few years ago. And finally, it's moving to New York. War Horse is about a boy and his pony, and it uses puppets to tell a deeply emotional story set during the cataclysm of World War I. Here's our theater correspondent, Jeff London.
Michael Morpurgo's novel is about a boy, Albert, and his beloved horse, Joey. The theatrical version is a different animal, say Toby Ollier and Matthew Burgess, two of War Horse's puppeteers.
The play had to tell the story of the horse being a central character, and the audience have to follow the journey of the horse without this horse becoming pantomimic or...
Anthropomorphic.
You know,
good word.
There we go. So the horse was never going to talk. It had to be something that was done visually.
What they've done visually has made London critics and audiences rapturous since the play first made its debut in a limited run at the National Theatre in 2007. The puppets are the thing. Enormous horse-sized puppets made of cane, canvas, and metal, designed by a South African company and each manipulated by a team of three puppeteers. These horse puppets gallop and trot, they snort and whinny, they carry human riders into battle. International Herald Tribune critic Matt Wolff says the puppets are at once both highly realistic and completely theatrical.
What's exciting about it is that you are aware of and you see the human machinery, as it were, that's helping bring these animals to life.
Creating this illusion requires great strength. Each puppet weighs well over 100 pounds without a rider. Matthew Burgess plays the heart of the lead horse, Joey.
We have the head who is outside the horse, the heart and the hind. Heart being the front legs and the hind being the back legs, who are inside the horse, if you like.
The movement of the ears and head, the flicking of the tail, the stamping of the hooves, these all communicate the horse's emotions. And the puppeteers don't just move like a horse, they sound like a horse. Ollier and Burgess demonstrate.
Let's do some snorty blowy stuff.
Yeah.
Wickering or nickering, there's a bit of which is the proper term, but yeah, a nicker, which is quite rumbly and a whinny. Should we do our different versions of it, because we've got quite different ones, haven't we?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Matthew Burgess says after a while, the teams kind of become the horse.
There are hours of work that we do predominantly with breath, actually, and the breath is the key to making the team work. That when we change breath or we change the rhythm of the breath, we know that the horse has changed its emotional state.
Easy, Joey. Easy now. Don't get excited. We'll get through this all right, don't you worry.
Puppeteer Matthew Burgess says World War I wasn't just a catastrophe for human beings.
8 million horses died during the First World War.
Yeah.
Is the figure that is given. And that shouldn't be forgotten.
War Horse has been such a success in London that the production is scheduled to come to the Lincoln Center Theater in New York next season. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London.
And now, from the London stage to American magazines. For more than a week, blogs and commentators were speculating on which celebrity was going to follow in the footsteps of Ellen DeGeneres and Lance Bass and come out on the cover of People magazine. Finally, the mystery was solved. And that star, country singer Shelley Wright. Ever since that People magazine cover, she's been all over TV and the internet.
Shelley Wright.
Shelley Wright.
Shelley Wright.
It's Cheryl Wright.
Shelley Wright.
It is Shelley Wright. What's her name?
Well, whatever it is, she's a really big star, and she's gay.
And that, as the entertainment channel TMZ put it, is the reason she's in the headlines. Selena Simmons-Duffin has more on the country music star.
Shelley Wright is 39 years old and has been making albums for nearly two decades. This week, she's publishing a new memoir. She's got a new album, a promotional tour, and a documentary about her is set to hit theaters in the fall, leaving some asking, is this a publicity stunt?
Well, I can't put a memoir about my coming out before I come out. Can I? Probably not.
That's Shelley Wright.
We're very realistic.
And that's her publicist, Howard Bragman. He's been managing celebrities who want to come out of the closet for about 20 years.
If Shelley Wright were to sit on the Today Show and say, hey, I'm Shelley Wright and I'm gay, they go, wow, that's great. Who are you? You know.
Bragman decided to take the opportunity and build the suspense. So instead of saying, who are you? Audiences would say, oh, you're the mystery gay celebrity.
It's a longer runway, if you will.
But just in case you're still wondering who she is, maybe you remember this song.
The single white female is looking for a man like you.
In her new album, Lifted Off the Ground, she's singing, yes, a very different tune.
And who's gonna end up holding your hand? A beautiful woman. Or a tall, handsome man.
Wright says her experiences with homophobia in the country music world convinced her to stay closeted throughout her career.
There's a reason no one's ever done this before me. They want you to be anything but gay. They would rather you be a drug addict, a wife beater, anything but this.
So to the critics that say this is just a stunt, Howard Bragman says, get a grip.
See, that's a real career maker in country music to come out of the closet and put your fan base at risk.
Still, he adds,
what a lot of the attention we're trying to get will hopefully do is help new people discover Shelley and her amazing voice.
Dare to be different. Dare to be true.
For NPR News, I'm Selena Simmons-Duffin.
Another side of the female experience is explored in a new film called Mother and Child. It's pretty much about what the title would suggest. Motherhood, its joys, sorrows, and strains. But it was written and directed by a man, Rodrigo Garcia. He'd created several parallel and intersecting stories that revolve around one character played by Annette Bening. Her name is Karen. She got pregnant when she was 14, and her mom made her give up the baby. We meet her four decades later, brittle, unmarried, caring for that mother, and working as a physical therapist and thinking constantly of the baby she never knew. Michelle Norris talked with Bening and Garcia about trying to capture the character's prickly yet vulnerable personality.
You know, I have to say that I shook my head several times during this film, amazed that a man had so effectively tapped into the complexities of the mother-daughter.
A man, you say that word, a man, like
no,
it's a, like it's
no,
some rude, like it's some
no,
rude word.
No. I have only love for the species. But I really was surprised, though, that you got it.
You know, I'm a junkie for this kind of behavior. I mean, I love, you know, so many things. I mean, a woman's face when she's shopping for shoes or seeing, you know, a woman's face when she looks up and the waiter is handsome. You know, that's just something that cannot be described. All that stuff. And I'm also fascinated by the real finesse they have, in reading social signals, you know, and reading each other. You know, I'll come back from a dinner with my wife and some friends and, you know, I come back in that masculine fog of mine and it was like, oh, that was fun. And my wife says to me, I don't think so. I think she's going to leave him. I'm like, oh, okay. You know, that kind of stuff. I love that kind of stuff.
It's wonderful to watch the dance, the very delicate dance between Karen and the character played by Jimmy Smits. He's clearly grooving on her. He has an eye for her. And your character is just so tough on him. He finally works up the courage to ask her out for a cup of coffee.
What else would you like to know?
We don't have to interrogate each other. This is not a date.
Interrogate's a harsh word.
What's so funny?
No, nothing. I just can't seem to say the right things around you, and I'm trying, believe me.
I'm not a difficult person.
No, I don't mean that.
No, you're not comfortable with me.
No, I am.
My words are too harsh.
No.
I love her, and I feel like she's trying so hard. She's as I think most of us do, trying so hard to connect but doesn't have the equipment. And I felt that was in the writing itself. So I loved doing that scene, and I could have gone on and done that for forever.
Was there some small thing that you did as an actor that was particularly special to you that you're hoping, that it's very subtle, that you're hoping that an audience might pick up, the way you reach for the box of Oreos or the way you hold your mother's necklace?
Don't say.
Yeah. It's a funny thing. I remember when I was in acting school, they did teach us a little bit about secrets, and that as an actor, you want to have some secrets. You want to have some things that you're not saying to anyone. And of course, it's only of use if it feeds you in the moment when you're trying to do something. But no, that is part of our job, is to have our secrets.
I was saying to Annette, don't say, because I think there has to be a part of the creative thing that should always be mysterious and should always be a secret of the artist. You know, one of the reasons I don't like to rehearse that much is because I want to, not just to encourage, you know, their own creativity, but because it's fun for me to see something created by them and I don't know where it comes from. I remember halfway through the shoot, I said to Annette, months from now, I'm going to call you, and I think you should tell me what your way into Karen was. I want to know what you thought of her, and you know all that stuff that I didn't know. And of course, now a year has gone by, and I see her, and I never ask, and I don't want to ask.
Here's your moment.
Well, no. In fact, at the beginning of the interview, you said to Annette, "How did you work on this character?" And I honestly, I found that I was about to blush because the whole thing was just too personal. Do you know what I mean? It's like, oh, God, I hope she doesn't say it. I don't want to hear it right now. I don't want to be shown, you know, the little compartment where the rabbit is hidden just before you bring it out of the hat.
You can hear the full interview at npr.org/culturetopia.
When I come back, there'll be no need to clock. I have enough money to buy out the blocks.
That's musician, entrepreneur, and sometimes philanthropist Wyclef Jean. On Tell Me More, we have an occasional series called In Your Ear, in which we ask our guests to tell us some of their favorite music. And for our latest, Wyclef Jean was our guest, and here's what he told us.
Yo, what's up, y'all? This is your boy, Wyclef Jean. And what am I listening to right now on my iPod? Miles Davis, Bitches Brew. Puts me in a mood and a setting. And the cool thing about Miles' music was it always took you to a place and a time where it's just natural meditation. So whenever I want to basically relax, you know, and get in the mood and in the vibe, that's one of the people that I love listening to, Miles Davis. And I'm also listening to Jimi Hendrix. As a guitar player, it always fascinates me the way Jimi created a whole style and a movement. And the fact that, you know, he's from a certain area, and that did not define the type of musician that he would become. And I love one of my favorite songs, of course, from Jimi is Angel. Where you going with that gun in your hand? Ba-doom, ba-doom, ba-doom. I mean, the guitar against his vocal, I really think is incredible, and that's one of my idols.
Okay, Alicia, it's been observed that the only time you can ever say the word bitches on NPR is if the word brew follows immediately after. That's true, and you'll be hearing from the lawyers if you don't follow that rule. Our conversation with Wyclef Jean on Tell Me More, we had a larger conversation before he told us about his music choices. And it was to recognize the first 100 days after the Haitian earthquake. And we talked pretty frankly with him about some of the questions raised about his charity, Yele Haiti, and he was fierce in defending his organization against charges that they misuse funds and misrepresent the scope of the work that they can do on the ground. He actually compared himself to Bob Marley as sort of a spokesman for his people and said it was his mission and an honor to represent the Haitian people around the world through his music and through his philanthropy. So it was a very interesting conversation. And now we have another story about representing in a very different world under very different circumstances. Lisa Kudrow, who was known as the Kooky One on the mega hit sitcom Friends, has become sort of a representative in her own way of Hollywood actresses of a certain age who've stopped getting the babe roles and are starting to be offered the crazy spinster aunt or the kooky neighbor. And she spoke with, the crazy neighbor. Now she's starring in an internet series called Web Therapy. And she spoke with NPR's Rebecca Roberts, who is guest hosting Talk of the Nation, about the freedom she has to experiment on the web.
Well, we were asked, Dan Bukatinski, my partner and I, we were asked to do a web series years ago, and the answer was no. Because we weren't really interested in doing that. Or they mostly seemed to be sitcoms that were broken up into 5-minute segments. And I kept thinking about it anyway. And I just had thought, well, if something's on the web, it should be quick and about the web. And then I just thought the worst idea in the world on the web would be a therapist who only sees people online on an iChat thing and for only 3 minutes.
And then add the fact that she's kind of a jerk, you know? I mean...
Right. So then we got to work with Don Roos also, you know, who's you know, executive producing this and directing. He's a, you know, writer, director. And we just figured out that what kind of person would do this or think it was a good idea? She had to be horrible and horribly stupid.
Well, let's play a clip.
I was really very hopeful when I switched you from the 50-minute in-person sessions to these truncated 3-minute sessions, hoping it would prompt you to get to your issues so that we could do some real work instead of the self-indulgent sort of blather, you know, that occupies a 50-minute session.
Right.
Alas, that hasn't happened.
Oh, gosh, I'm sorry.
That was Dan Bukatinski playing Jerome.
Do you, how much of it is scripted and how much of it is improv?
Well, we write the outlines so that we know, you know, what story points need to be hit. And then we improvise. The actors improvise.
Is it hard to keep a straight face?
Yeah, that's really hard.
You said that you wanted a web series to be about the web. And that we should say it's set up that you see these two chat windows, sometimes one or the other. But it looks like a desktop. And there's sort of business around the side of the desktop that's also part of your characters, what she would have on her computer. I mean, it's all sort of set up to give you some insight into the character.
Yeah, if you care to look at it. In the first season, you see, you know, a folder for Lockman Brothers, which is some financial institution we made up that she was working at. And then, you know, possibly was blackmailing them over some sexual harassment suit. That's how she's getting funded. Yeah, you can see folders for certain files. There's an evidence file, and she's just always collecting things, and yeah.
You can hear the full interview at npr.org/culturetopia. Now turning to something a little bit more contemporary. In 1995, the British jazz pop duo Everything But the Girl scored an unlikely hit with a dance remix of their song, Missing. Singer Tracy Thorne and her longtime partner and now husband, Ben Watt, haven't recorded as Everything But the Girl in about 9 years, but their partnership is alive and well. Thorne took an extended hiatus from the music business to raise the couple's 3 children, but she reappeared a few years ago with a solo album, and her latest is a stark, powerful record called Love and Its Opposite. Thorne recently spoke with Guy Raz about the album and some of the song's underlying themes.
A lot of this record is about second chances in middle age. Is that sort of what you wanted to say right now at this point?
Well, I'm certainly... You know, I'm flying the flag for this kind of subject matter as being something that I think is worthy of being written about in pop music. And it's the kind of subject matter that isn't often used as subject matter for pop lyrics. I just worry that if people carry on making music but write lyrics always from the perspective of younger people, that they're actually missing a trick, you know? There's quite a lot of interesting stuff, it seems to me, that carries on happening to people as they get older. And I think there's a lot of sort of conflict-type experiences that carry on happening into middle age.
You write about it in one song called Singles Bar, and it's about a woman, I'm assuming, presumably divorced, sort of gaining the courage to go out to meet someone new.
Is there room for one more at the singles bar? I've been working up the courage all year. I pull off my ring as I push my way in. Won't be needing it here.
Some people have said to me they find that song really sad, but, you know, there's also an element to that song that's quite playful, I think. You know, it's partly based on the experiences of friends of mine who found themselves unexpectedly single again. And, you know, they've shared with me, you know, some of the stories of what it's like being out there dating again. And some of it's not pretty.
Can you guess my age in these jeans? Can you tell me what any of this means?
I want to ask you about a track on the record, and it's called Hormones. First, I want to listen to these lyrics.
Yours are just kicking in, mine are just checking out. You're at the beginning of this tunnel, and I'm just coming out.
I'm guessing that lyrics like yours are just kicking in, mine are just checking out. I'm guessing this song has something to do with what you're experiencing as a parent of teenagers.
Yeah, I've got 2 daughters now who are 12 years old now, and I'm 47. So, you know, it just struck me one day that here we are, we're at opposite ends of the hormonal spectrum, and I thought it's not a song I've heard before. You know, despite the fact that there are, you know, lots of other women out there carrying on making records through this kind of age, but, you know, many of them seem to prefer to take the route of clinging on to eternal youth rather than actually admitting to the fact that, you know, as you get older, things change.
What do your kids think about your music?
Oh, well, you know, they're barely interested, as seems to be completely normal for kids approaching teenagerdom. You know, the stuff of their peer group is far more interesting to them than what their dear old mum's doing.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Alicia Montgomery.
And I am Netta Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.